Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome once again. We are going to have, didn't really count it up before we went on the air, but this has got to be 15, 16, 17, I don't know which number of book it is we're interviewing Laura Lippman for, but it's around that number.
Well, it's my 16th novel, and there's been a novella, too. I don't know if I made it in for that, but so yeah, I would say it might be the 16th time.
Laura Lippman's
back. It sounds plausible.
The Most Dangerous Thing is her new novel. It's not one of her Tess Monahan series, but that's okay. So the Most Dangerous Thing is this latest work. And welcome. It's good to see you again.
Always good to see you. Good to be here.
And now you've been a mother for?
A little over a year, since May of 2010.
Georgia Ray, you dedicated the book to her. The
book is dedicated to her, even though probably no one did more to keep me from writing it than she did. But she informed it. It was actually a very interesting thing that happened. I had managed to write the first 14 or so chapters, the first part of the book was done before she was born. The second part of the book is 10 chapters told from the point of view of the parents. The first part of the book is very much from the point of view of the kids,
right?
Moving back and forth between the present and the past, when they were friends in the past, and in the present when they're not friends, but they're brought together by a death of one of this group of five. And it takes you to this chaotic, awful night in which something terrible happens.
Something terrible does happen.
Which does jibe historically with Hurricane David, very relevant in Baltimore, although I took some liberties with exactly how the storm happened. And then it was time to write about how the parents saw the ensuing events of the next 2 years. You're seeing the parents in 1979 and 1980, and this is a book about two groups of people, each with a secret, and the tragic collision of one group not knowing the other's secrets, and it goes back and forth, and those 10 chapters about the parents, I feel as if I worked on them for 10 years, which obviously is impossible. But mm-hmm. when I look back at writing this book and what I found out, I had a lot of hubris about how being a parent would change me as a writer, because what people kept saying is it would change the way I wrote about kids. And I didn't see that. I'd been a kid. I'm not sentimental about childhood. I think children are interesting, and I've always tried to write them in my books as full people. Some are good, some are bad. Most of them are in between. They make mistakes. They're interesting to me because of their lack of guile. They try to be. Mm-hmm. They try to be sneaky, but they're really not very good at it. If you know kids, that's what's interesting, is they're trying to do all this sneaky stuff and you can see through them. And I was right about that. I didn't write the kids in this book differently. Then I got to these parents, and that is what had changed. I had so much more empathy for parents. And it was humbling, because I like to think that I had a lot of empathy for all of the characters I've written in every novel, but there was a change and I couldn't deny it. And it really slowed me down when I hit this one section of the book.
Writing about the parents.
Yes. It took forever.
And I can see that, and I can feel that in the second part of the book, which is coming from the parents' point of view. But you're also, what really struck me is this, and as we always say, I never really quite finish a book before you come in, because I don't want to know the ending in the midst of our conversation. But there's this other you've kind of created, this almost mythical, mystical voice that kind of surrounds all of them.
There is an unusual device in this book, and I expect to be asked a lot of questions about it, which is that the scenes in the past are told in the first person plural. And it is never identified exactly what is going on. I don't have a problem, because it's not a mystery that's revealed in the final pages. What I feel comfortable telling people is that this is a consensual version of events by those who are still living to tell it.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of the journey in this book is there was a group of five friends who were stronger as a unit than they were as individuals. They part ways. Many years later, one of them dies. And they have to find their way back to the group. And the consensual version of events, the reason that it's important, is it's not particularly flattering to anyone. You know, we're talking about three brothers, Tim, Sean, and Gordon, who's known as Go-Go. A girl called Gwen, who's, you know, the youngest by a lot, child of a doctor and his wife, and a little bit pampered. And a tomboy, for want of a better word, named Mickey, a girl. Mm-hmm. And if you read these sections, and they're only in the first part of the book, and then it comes back at the very end, this consensual voice, you can't imagine, for example, that Gwen would say some of the things that are said about Gwen in these passages, even though she's a writer and you might suspect she's the one who's telling the version. You know, would someone really talk about themselves this way? And you realize that, I realize that they had sort of gotten together and agreed that the only thing they could do, so much has gone wrong, so many bad things have happened, so many wrongs can't be righted, but they can be honest and they can be truthful with each other, and they can tell the unvarnished truth about what happened then and what is happening now.
In many ways, what strikes me about this book is, I mean, it's you have become a mystery novelist.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a mystery here.
There is a crime.
It's
absolutely
a crime. But it's approached in a very different way. In terms of the it's not necessarily just built around the whodunit.
Right, although that is a question mark in a way. Or
right.
There's some confusion about what happened, and there is a death. There are two deaths.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I almost hesitate to tell the story on myself because it's a hard story to tell without sounding like a jerk, because it's a story that's nice about me. Every year I teach at Eckerd College in St. Petersburg, Florida. There's a week-long workshop that was started by my friend Dennis Lehane,
mm-hmm.
and I've been teaching there since 2006, and I'm going back next year. And it's got a top-flight faculty. I'm really honored to have been included in the faculty there. And this year, some of the people who were there were, you know, the writer Tom Perata, Ann Hood, John Dufresne. I mean, really outstanding. Right? Rick Russo came to speak as sort of the star spot, the guest lecturer. And we always read from our works in progress. And I happened to be grouped with Tom Perata. And we had our readings that night. And I read the chapter in the section that I said gave me such fits, and probably this chapter gave me more fits than anything. It's the chapter about the 4th of July parade in Dickeyville.
Oh, right.
And how this one father, Tim Sr., who's often not a very good father.
Tim Hanrahan.
Yeah. He has this moment where he really rallies, and he does all the right things, and he's great. And he has this heartbreaking moment when he realizes that's not going to fix what happened to his youngest kid. He can't fix him. He doesn't know how. He doesn't know how to talk about things. And I read that chapter, and Tom read from his terrific new book, which I think is going on sale about the same time, which is this wonderful book about, you know, sort of this future dystopia where people just disappear off the face of the earth, and it's kind of like, you know, Judgment, but maybe not. No one knows. It's told from the point of view of the people who watch people disappear off the face of the earth, and they don't know. And we were walking away from the auditorium together, and Tom said, "So you're really not a crime writer anymore?" And I said, "No, I'm a crime writer. I am a crime writer because I believe that the genre has no inherent limits. And as long as I write a novel about a crime, I'm going to be a crime novelist. I'm coming from the center of the genre and pushing outward." There's some other really terrific literary writers who have sort of been making incursions on the edges and doing brilliant work. I'm thinking primarily of Daniel Woodrow. You could argue that Richard Price is one of those people, that he sort of comes into the edges and takes pieces of like the police procedural and makes them his own. But I started as a mainstream crime writer, and I'll never predict exactly what I'm going to do, but for now, I don't see that changing. I just decided that the genre had no limits. Me, I probably have plenty of limits, and I'm going to probably find out what
they
are.
We'll see.
might have found him in this book. But I just think this is a really malleable genre and an accommodating one. One of my favorite writers right now is Kate Atkinson. I've had the good luck to meet her and get friendly with her. There's no one else like her. She's a literary writer who, you know, started off about as well as anyone starts off. Her first book was called Behind the Scenes at the Museum, and it won it won a huge prize in England, a best novel prize. And then she decided a couple years ago to start writing these novels about a private detective named Jackson Brody. And they're crime novels by a literary writer, and I've never read anything like them. It's like the best of both worlds, and very few writers can really do that. It's almost like if you're a tennis player, either your forehand or your backhand's going to be better, and you're going to do one thing better. But she does everything superbly. I mean, she's in her style and her technique. She's a marvelous writer. But the stories just have you on the edge of your seat, too. And you're like, I can't, oh my goodness, what's going on anyway? So, yeah, and I'm still a crime writer. Long way to get to that point.
No, no.
And I'm not trying to be anything other than a crime novelist.
But what struck me about this, and having really read all of your books, and now I want to read her books now. I've not read.
And I've done my good deed for the day.
I can't wait to snatch one of those. But this is a crime novel, but it's also about the power and frailties of human beings, of who we are as parents, as adults, in our relationships with the person we're committed to or not committed to, and how we wrestle through those, and how we view life through what truth to tell and what truth not to tell as children, and the rest. So
yes.
You're exploring those are the edges you're exploring here.
And it's a novel about middle age. It's not an accident that a character in this book that says middle age is a horror film.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because it is. Last year I was writing this book. In the space of 1 month, we lost my father-in-law, who had been sick for a long time, and that wasn't so surprising, but it was, of course, devastating. And then my husband's longtime collaborator.
Right.
Died of a stroke. He wasn't even 50.
Right.
You know, went over on set one day down in New Orleans. And that's what middle age is like. This past month, first Connie Knox, my former colleague at the Baltimore Sun, retires after a long career there, dies in her sleep this summer. And right on the heels of that, someone that I knew from my summer camp days, I want to call him a young man because he is forever that in my head. I've known him since we were teenagers together. He committed suicide. And when that happened, it made me recall something my editor had said when I turned in this book. This book begins with a death that may or may not be a suicide by a young demon-riddled... He's not so young. He's turning 40, but again, he seems young to me. A demon-riddled man named Gogo. And my editor said, you know, everybody knows someone like this.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows a person who just can't escape their past. And I was telling people, I said, so two people I know died this week, and I'm more surprised by the death of a 68-year-old woman in her sleep than I am by the suicide of a 50-year-old man who actually the last time I saw him seemed to be doing pretty well. I want to be more surprised at his death. I want to be really shocked by it. But if I'm being honest, I'm not that surprised. And that, you know, that was really kind of like sad. And this is middle age. Your friends die.
Mm-hmm.
And you just think, wow, I thought I was just finally getting to some place where you feel like you've gotten to this kind of comfortable place if you're happy with your life. And it's like, this is good. I know how to do this and I know how to do this. And, you know, I'm not worried about being cool anymore. So that's a big thing off the, you know, agenda. It's like I've left that behind long ago. And there comes this moment when you find yourself walking down the street wearing something so awful and so impossible and thinking, 15 years ago, I would have set myself on fire rather than leave the house like this. And now I don't care and nobody cares. And I think one of the great gifts of of being 50 or in my 50s as I am, is you realize actually no one's ever looking at you. You know, you're much more, you would be surprised at how little other people think about you. And it's a great gift. But, and then you start going to funerals.
So you do go, and that doesn't end.
No, the pace is just going to accelerate.
It's more
accelerate.
Intense.
Yeah.
And it makes you stop and think about things in a very different way. And then you have that, and you're balanced with that with having a little one.
Yeah, which is unusual. I mean, I have, you know, I have this atypical middle age in that I'm raising a very young child. Although if you look around Baltimore, there are a lot of women who are raising young children. It tends to be their grandchildren. So I'm not that out of step in some ways in the city. And I certainly, you know, I never complain about it. I mean, because it was so clearly chosen. You don't end up being a mom at 52 by accident. That's a great gift. So I feel like I'm in these two very different places. I'm very much in middle age. And then at the same time, I've sort of been thrown backward in time. And I'm having experiences that people generally have in their 20s and 30s, generally. That's when people experience having small children. It puts me in contact with people a lot younger than I am, you know, just inevitably, you know.
Because you have a kid.
Yeah. So I love that. I love pretty much everything about it, being a parent. And it's such a cliche, but of course the great glory of it is you get to see someone experiencing things for the first time. And you remember how much you've decided to take for granted. Or not decided, you just do. You know, that the wonder of everything, the wonder of standing up for the first time, of taking a few steps, of seeing a dog, mm-hmm. you know, and then knowing what a dog is, of seeing someone, you know, beloved to you walk through the door. And that's all really cool.
And this, but what's happening to me in this novel as I'm reading it is that it's, I got to put this, it's the lack of being judgmental about what happens to people, what people do. The complexities of what people face in the decisions they have to make about their lives.
You know, someone who had read the novel told me they found it unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, it is a sad novel. I do find it. I myself do not really understand why. I think I'm a reasonably happy person. I have a great life. And I write these really melancholy books. You know, and I don't know, but I think that they represent my worldview pretty accurately, where I think there are a lot of just small tragic moments that come out of people not being able to really face up to who they are. One thing I realized in writing this book is that something I think I struggle with and do think is a really big failing is when people are incurious about other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably one of the biggest mistakes that the five main characters in this book make.
That they're not curious?
That they meet this man in the woods and they don't really think about him as anything other than being there for their amusement and entertainment and benefit. Which, of course, defines childhood in a way. And you grow out of it, one hopes, but it's not a good thing. It's not a good thing to only think of other people in terms of what they do for you, what they provide for you, to not have a curiosity about them that goes beyond how they're interacting with you. They just accept it as, here's this man, he lives in the woods, he lets us come to his house to play. Why wouldn't he? And they find him interesting because they don't know everything about him, because he comes and goes in ways that aren't explained. But, you know, they treat him like a toy in a way, something to be thrown away.
But one of the things you capture about that, to me, in this book, is that I think all kids have this, most children, end up having this mystery in their lives they can't talk about. that they can't touch.
Yes. And also, I think there's a smaller universal truth, which is kids are constantly trying to figure things out on their own without benefit of full context that sometimes will not come for years. And we love to tell this story in our family. I'm also a stepmom, and I've been a stepmom for, you know, I guess technically 5 years, but really longer than that. And one day when my stepson was really young, he couldn't have been more than 7, we were watching The Simpsons together.
Because he's a teenager now, right?
Yeah. And he asked me why the character of Sideshow Bob kept trying to kill Krusty the Clown. And I've always been very circumspect in anything that sort of runs along the lines of a moral lesson. I mean, I always felt like, you know, he has parents. If I don't know exactly what they would say about something, I should be very careful and not imprint my ideas on him because he's got parents. So I was trying to be very neutral and not talk about people being good or bad or envy or vengeance or, you know, it's just a cartoon. Why do you care? So I said about Sideshow Bob, I said, well, he has issues. Yeah. Neutral, throwaway line. And my stepson took this very much to heart, and he thought about it, and he nodded and said, yes, he has very big shoes. We use that term in our family to this day to describe someone who's, you know, got a lot of baggage. We're like, he has really big shoes. And it's such a beautiful moment because it's a kid who's been told something that doesn't make any sense, but he's trying to make it make sense within a vocabulary and an experience and a context that he understands. There's also a great moment like that in the marvelous book Ramona the Pest, where she hears the Star Spangled Banner and the words make no sense to her.
Didn't make sense to any of us, did they?
Exactly. And she's like, she thinks that the dawn's early light is the Donzer Lee light, something that can be switched on. Mm-hmm. And later in the book, when her dad can't quite see to read its newspaper, she says, why don't you switch on the Donzer light? And she gets laughed at. And, oh, she's so hurt and so miserable. And I, you know, there's so much in childhood we don't understand until really like 30 years later. And a lot of it involves our parents.
Yes.
A lot of it is, wow, I never thought about what my parents were going through until I actually went through it myself.
But that's one of the reasons I think I love this book so much. A couple of things that popped in my head as you were just talking. But let me talk about the book thing first that popped in my head. Is that's what happens in this book. It's the interplay between Gwen and her father and the mother who passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And the complexities of you don't know everything as a child viewing your parents' relationship in terms of what went on between them. And we may not get to that until we become parents ourselves in our 40s and 50s and can understand what might have gone on there is what's also happening to us now.
Gwen, in some ways, has repeated a lot of her mother's mistakes, not even knowing that her mother made mistakes.
Right.
And, you know, she's been set down that path. But she has this incredibly romanticized version
of her mom,
of her parents,
of
their marriage. To her, my father loved my mother so much. They had the best marriage. Why isn't my marriage like that? You know, why doesn't my husband worship me? And, you know, late in the book, when her father tells her the full story of what he knows and what she needed to believe in, and you know, Clem is the oldest character in the book by quite a lot. I will tell you something about this book that was kind of hilarious. In keeping people's ages straight in this book.
Well, they're all over the place.
Well, you know, it's like why I did this to myself. And, you know, I want to give a shout out because it is to someone who lives in Baltimore. You know, my publisher, HarperCollins, provides me with a copy editor, and that person does a good job, and they go through the book. But for the past 3 books, I believe I have that right, I have hired Allison Chaplin, formerly of the Baltimore Sun, who worked with me as a copy editor there, was also a writer.
Yeah.
And Allison does the most marvelous work on these books. And my books are so much better in terms of accuracy. She's identified a lot of little bad rhetorical tics that I had. I mean, it's pretty, and so Without her, I could have never gotten this done. And even with Allison's help, sitting down. And then on top of that, I have a character who lies about her age and lies about her husband's age. So, like,
right.
It took 2 days of just making charts and trying to figure out when everybody's birthday was. Because first of all, you know, it's not like everybody's born on January 1st. It's not like you come to a certain year and you're like, okay, now it's 1979. So everybody's like, no, you have to figure out when everyone's birthday is and if that tracks. But Clem is the oldest character by far in the book. I mean, is he 88 or 89 when the book starts?
He turns 88.
Yeah. And so he's actually older than my own father, even though I'm a little bit older than the characters in the book. And he is very much the moral center of the book. He's certainly the sage of the book. He's seen the most. He knows the most. He's the most imbued with regret, I would say. And yet at the same time feels that there's almost nothing he can do with this knowledge. But, you know, he was a really important character to me. And, you know, toward the end of the book is when he and his daughter have a heart-to-heart, when a lot of things are revealed that I think surprise both of them on both sides. And, yeah, it's not a, when you're a writer, it's not a trick loving a character like Clem, who's smart and intellectual and probably shares my worldview and, you know, loves Baltimore, you know, goes to Lexington Market and loves everything he sees there. You know, the big challenge were the characters such as the parents of the three boys, Tim and Doris.
Mm-hmm.
Tim especially, I had to work very hard to find his heart, but I think I did. No character surprised me more in terms of how indomitable she was than Rita, the worst parent in the bunch by far. I wrote her. I'm not going to make excuses for her. She's a really bad parent, but she doesn't think so. And she rationalizes every step of the way that the things she does in pursuit of her own personal happiness will make her a better mom. Because if she's happy, if she's with this guy instead of that guy, there's a good reason for it, even though the other guy might be more stable. And something I didn't see coming is when we catch up with Rita in the present day, she has no regrets. None. And it's like, oh my God, you don't even understand why your daughter won't pick up the phone to call you.
And her daughter coming to realize why all this happened. I mean, what the change she goes through when she finally realizes, when she blurts out earlier in the book what her mother is, and she,
yes,
to her, and she doesn't even, and it shocks her that she's saying it.
Yeah. And she's got two kids, both of whom are probably better than they should be, you know, given the life she gave them. And yet,
Joey and Mickey.
Yeah. I kind of like her.
Well, she's,
there's something about her, you know, you see her down in Florida. She's got rheumatoid. She hasn't aged well. I mean, she certainly has, but she doesn't feel sorry for herself. I think that, in a lot of ways, is what saved that character for me, that there's no self-pity. And by the time she's older, there's not a lot of bull either. She knows who she is, and she knows what choices she made, and she's not denying any of them.
We're talking with Laura Lippman. Her latest mystery novel, is called The Most Dangerous Thing. It's just popping out on the stands. Tomorrow night, you can meet Laura with this book in a conversation at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble on St. Paul Street.
Right, in Charles Village.
In Charles Village, on Tuesday night, the 23rd. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Continue our conversation with Laura Lippman about her book, The Most Dangerous Thing. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I'm sitting in the studio here in our studios in Hamden with Laura Lippman, The Most Dangerous Thing. You're hearing this on WEAA on The Mark Steiner Show, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And you can meet Laura tomorrow night with this book, The Most Dangerous Thing, She'll be at the Barnes & Noble on St. Paul Street, which is in Charles Village. What I was thinking about is with these characters, we're talking about them. First of all, Clem. There's a couple things I have to say today. Clem. It reminded me of my dad.
Oh, interesting.
He reminded me of what also my father taught me about relationships later in life. As crazy as I was watching them as a kid, I got to understand more about the complexities of life through his being honest about what happened to him. So Clem, in some ways, did that with Gwen.
Yes, he's trying to set her straight. I think actually, you know, and I won't be giving anything away, but I think at the end of the book, Clem gives Gwen some pretty good advice. She doesn't take all of it. It's funny, she doesn't take it for herself, but she absorbs it and she passes it along to someone else who's also in need of it. And, like, you know, she's like, she didn't do it, she didn't follow it, but she really believes that this friend should. And she probably does help the friend in passing that information along. You know, I said that he was a really easy character to like and to spend time with. One of the characters that sort of caught me off guard, I didn't realize how much I was going to like him and what an incredibly decent, respectable, intelligent person he was going to turn out to be, was Tim Jr.
Mm-hmm.
Tim is the oldest of the three Halloran boys, and he's always referred to by Clem. Clem, who's usually very nice about everyone, calls Tim Jr. the lummox. And he turns out to be what I would call a real mensch.
Because he has clarity about himself and what he was doing, I think.
He does. And he also, he's in a great relationship. He's someone who, you know, I think that people who meet the right person when they're very young, and I have a good friend like this. I have a friend, I was her bridesmaid when we were 22 years old.
And they're still together.
And they're still together. By the way, I told her when she made it to 25 years, I said, I thought you were crazy. But
25 years together in a relationship, you mean?
No, when she celebrated her 25th wedding anniversary. I was like, on your wedding day, I thought you were nuts. But she's really proved me wrong, and I've never been happier to be wrong. I think people who meet the right person when they're very young, that's like winning a lottery. I just think that's, you know.
Amen.
And the thing is it's – you really have to talk about a leap of faith. You know, the idea – this is the right person for me. I'm 21. I'm 22. I've really met the person I'm going to spend the right. That's, you really just have to plunge in. Tim Jr. has that. I just was very interested in his relationship with these three daughters who just have him so whipped. I mean, you know, you see him going to these conversations with the two teenagers. They're two teenagers and a younger one. And here he is. He's an assistant state's attorney. And he cannot win with them. He just can't.
They're smart.
I love it when he at one point, you know, discovers that his middle daughter and a friend have a joint. And he assistant state's attorney goes into a conversation with a teenage girl and says that he's going to send it to the crime lab and determine which girl really and one of the girls just looks at him blandly and says, the crime lab's too backed up to do that, and you can't get that kind of information. I'm not letting you swab my cheek for DNA.
Swab my cheek.
I know my rights. And he's just like, he feels utterly defeated that, you know, the law and order has made it impossible for him to bluff, you know, these kids. And I was, you know, and he's very tender with his mother, who clearly needs someone to be tender with her, who is not the strongest character in the book. And
not the deepest bulb in the book either.
No. And
been through a bunch.
You know, one of the things that has been brought up to me is that this book takes a rather mixed view on the subject of honesty. And I said, well, yeah, because I think a lot of times when people say they're being honest, they're not really interested in honesty. They're interested in being forgiven. They're interested in having their own consciences cleared. And I don't consider that to be particularly altruistic. You know, if you're being honest because you're placing a burden on the other person to absolve you, to forgive you, what's the value in that? And, you know, it's different if you're being honest and you're prepared to have the other person say, no, I can't forgive that. No, I won't forgive that. Or that's something so large that it's beyond me to forgive you. And, you know, Doris burdens someone in this novel with a really big secret, and there's nothing right about it. It's just too big a secret for her. Actually, there's something kind of mean about it, I think. Even if she doesn't recognize it, I think when she shares this secret, which has many consequences late in the book, she's being really unkind. And
she's a very calculating woman.
In her own way.
In her own way, she's a very calculating woman. Whether it's that or whether it's what she's trying to get out when she brings another scene, which we won't talk about too deep, but when she brings the cookies over.
Yes.
To the door.
She can be very, or you know, even
these are all very calculating moves.
Like when you see her interactions with, she, you know, there's a scene in the past where you see her talking to Tally. You know, Doris is the mother of Tim, Sean, and Gogo. Tally is the mother of Gwen, and Sean and Gwen have had a very puppy love kind of relationship, and it's over
at 14.
And Tally. She's not sure what the barbs are about, but she knows that Doris takes the most bland, innocuous sentiments and makes them sound a little bit accusing. Like, that girl just gets prettier every day. And Tally registers that as something negative and doesn't know where it's coming from and doesn't know what Doris knows or thinks she knows about the relationship between the two kids. And yet at the same time, you know, my heart goes out to this character when I see the story of how she tries to clean her house for the visit of a priest that she can't help having a crush on, knowing it's very Thornbirds, knowing it's all impossible. But, you know, and he's going to come to the house and she spends the entire day cleaning. It's immediately undone by the arrival home of her husband and her three sons. And that sad little detail that she hides the pound cake because she's made two, and it's so important to her tomorrow that when she sets her table, somehow the image of the two beautiful, perfect loaves is key. And she won't even share one loaf with the family, and she has to hide them. Just, you know, you know, I talk about this as if it's something, a story someone else told me and I have no idea where it came from, which on some level is true. But, you know, again, with all of these characters, even the characters who behave very badly and do things that people in this book do things that cannot be forgiven.
Pretty horrible things.
Horrible things have happened in this book. And, you know, I'm so much more interested in what I'll call little deaths. You know, the kind of deaths that would never be page one news. Guy drives his car into the end of the barricade at the end of Route 70. Man dies under mysterious circumstances. No one ever figures out what happened, and no one really seems to care.
Right.
That's so much more interesting to me than, you know, I don't want to use a specific example. I'm just, while I recognize the entertainment factor in books and movies about ingenious serial killers, those are truly fantasies. And those are actually the entertainments that distract us. Because when that is over, you go home or you close the book and you're not the least bit worried about that ever happening to your family.
Right.
So that is escapism. And escapism is fine. I'm all for it. But it's not what interests me. I like to make people a little uncomfortable.
Well, all your novels make people a little uncomfortable. But the difference in this novel to, let's say, one of your Tess Monahan stories, or the earlier Tess Monahan stories especially, is the unraveling of a mystery that is a crime.
Mm-hmm.
What really happened here?
Mm-hmm.
Who really might have done this? Do we really know where it's going to end up? This is more of stories built around very human dramas that you may, but even before the book is over, know what happened in certain parts of it, but that's not the real story. The story is the human drama unfolding in people's lives, in their families, in their relationships, and where this ends or doesn't end up.
It was a, you know, I don't think my politics are a secret. You know, I'm pretty darn liberal, verging on lefty.
Global warming's even with the book.
Of course, climate change. You know, I mean, I really am someone who, during the recent events on our political landscape, was saying, I should be paying more taxes. I should be. You don't tax me enough, but I'm so disgusted at how things are going that I'm not sure you do the right thing. But I should be paying more taxes. I recognize that. So that's how kind of lefty I am. So my politics aren't a secret. And one of the things that really gave me pause as I had been writing crime fiction for a while is that crime fiction is essentially a very conservative form that starts with a social order that's been disrupted, and the journey of the book is to restore it, which implies that it was in order to begin with and that you approve of the order and that you think that finding out who done it can set the world right again. And at some point I decided, yes, you can put the world back together, but it's like putting back together a vase that's cracked into about, 30, 40 pieces. Mm-hmm. The cracks are all there. It will never be pretty again. It was never pretty to begin with, probably. It just had the illusion of being pretty. And that's what interests me. What interests me are events that make it impossible for people to go forward saying, everything is nice, everything is lovely, I have food on my table, I'm doing just fine. I like to write about people who are very much like me, and who have to just face up to the way they've rationalized certain events into not being, or they've rationalized their behavior to a point where it really is insupportable.
One of the things the book is so – your writing is good in that you've reached a point in your writing after 16 books and a novella is that you, A, start from a place that you know and places that you know, not in places that have no relationship to you whatsoever, even down to the places where you grew up in the park.
Yes. By the way, you're more suited than most people to really understand the physical, because you grew up not that far away from me.
Right. And I spent 25 years living in Windsor Hills, which is right on that park, on Leakin Park.
So, Dickeyville, which is the setting for this novel, and it's where I lived as a kid, I have waited years to write my Dickeyville novel. And people say, what's – it's like, you don't understand. I was going to get one shot. I'm going to get one shot at writing about this place, which I love.
Yeah.
I adored. And I considered my childhood idyllic. And I said –
And that comes through in this.
It was a beautiful place. I mean, I think that I had sort of one of the best childhoods someone could have, having that immense freedom to wander in nature. I mean, one of the cool things about Dickeyville is you're living in Baltimore City and – The city part of the city is only 15, 20 minutes away, but it was like living in the country at the same time. Right. You had all this nature, and I really did. Today, driving here, I went down, through Stonehill. I was like, why don't I live in Stonehill?
it's a great little neighborhood.
Oh, it's beautiful. So beautiful. And sort of the best, again, you have like these little stone houses, and it looks wild and green, and yet, you're steps away from the Jones Falls. And Dickeyville was really important to me, and I waited a long time. I've been circling it. I've been coming closer and closer. It's like, it's mentioned in Every Secret Thing, but not by name. And then in What the Dead Know, you're just about a mile and a half up on the other side of Forest Park.
Right.
And in Life Sentences, the main character lives on the other side of Forest Park Avenue in what is technically Dickeyville, but just one of three houses on what was known as Hill Lane. Like, but here it is. This was it. And, it's funny because – I'm really uninhibited about the fact that people think they know that characters in my books are based on real people. They're not. They're simply not. But it's a very human way to think about fiction, because even I, who writes novels, was fascinated to read that Philip Roth book, The Facts, which he wrote about his own work, and to see how he had harvested incidents from his life to use in his work, which ultimately tells us nothing. I mean, I do think writers use events. I certainly used one in a work in progress. I just the other day, something happened to me, and I was like, oh, you know what? That somehow fits in the novel. I think I'll just take that and stick it in there. I do that all the time, but I don't use people. But I know
don't you extrapolate out of the reality you walk through?
Yeah.
Right?
But, I mean, it's such a, you know, what I have made peace with the fact that people are going to read this book and they're going to think they know. I know that Gogo is so-and-so. Well, no, you don't, because Gogo is Gogo. You know, James Cain had this great line in a piece that he wrote, an introduction to one of his books. And he was talking about how people always compared him to Dashiell Hammett. Mm-hmm. And they even talked about some critic apparently had made a wisecrack about his Hammett and Tong style. He said, I've never read Dashiell Hammett. And even if I had, it doesn't quite work like that. And, you know, he said, you know, writers don't look at another writer and say, well, he seems to be doing pretty well, so I'll just rip him off and be utterly derivative. He's like, it just doesn't work that way. So I don't like look at someone and say, aha. Yeah, you would make a great character in my novel, and I'll just... And yet, people can't stop reading it that way. My own husband can't stop reading the books that way and thinking that he knows this character, even though... And by the way, sometimes when I'm watching The Wire or Treme, I do the same thing to him, and I'm wrong, although this is a story. This is a bit of a tangent, but it just cracked me up so much. I was watching Treme this season, and... I heard one of the characters, the character played by Clark Peters, and for those who don't watch the show, and based on the ratings, apparently there are a couple of you who don't, which is a bad mistake. You should be watching it.
Amazing,
brilliant.
Series. Oh, my God.
Clark Peters plays the character of Albert.
Right.
And he's having an argument with his son.
The chief.
And the son said, do you always have to have the last word? And Albert said no, and he stalked off. And that really jibed my memory. Last summer, David and I were having a very playful conversation that I wrote in my phone because it made us laugh so hard. And what I said, he said to me, do you always have to have the last word? And I said, according to what was written in my phone, not necessarily. Which, as I pointed out to David, is funnier but wouldn't have worked for Albert in that situation. So that was one case where David was out of the country and I emailed him and said, did you take that? And he said, just some tribute. So, you know, it is very complicated where, and it's very hard, no matter how sophisticated one is, it's very hard to shut off that part of your brain who wants to say, you know, the house that the Robesons live in is utterly fictitious. You can walk to the end of Wethersfield Road and
there.
You will never find that house.
I drove, you know, you made me so crazy with that house. That I drove the long way to say, is that house there? And, of course, it's not there. But I thought, is it there? Did I see that house once?
And then on Seacott's Lane, I put four houses on there when there are really only three. And so I can tell people, well, the Hallorans live in the fictitious fourth house. Uh-huh. Purnell Village, I didn't do anything to disguise. It's, like, large enough so that if people think they know exactly which townhouse that Mickey and her family lived in. but, yeah, you know, you just see – I when I first started writing – now, and we're talking a long time ago because I started what became my first novel back in 1993. So we're talking almost 20 years ago. I thought people are going to think whatever they want to think. And it's out of my control. And the only thing I said to myself is I'm not going to embarrass anyone close to me. I'm not going to create characters that make people say, well, that's your dad, that's your mom, that's your sister. I wouldn't create a character now where someone would say, that's your husband. Mm-hmm. Except you find out that people say it anyway, no matter how far right. You go out of your way. I mean, I had someone who read the Tess Monahan books who did not think my father was represented in Tess Monahan's father because they're nothing alike. But there's a character, a lawyer, who's in a wheelchair. And one of my friends actually said to me, what are the Freudian implications of you putting your father in a wheelchair? I didn't. It doesn't, like James Cain, it doesn't quite work that way.
That's great. Well, I think this to me, the most interesting is a leap from previous work.
I think it's the best thing I've ever written. I mean, that's a really full of yourself thing to say. I'm usually pretty neurotic when a book comes out, and I prepare myself for bad reviews. And by the way, this book will probably get bad reviews. Every book, I mean, in our new sort of digital democracy, everyone gets to be a reviewer.
Right.
So
right, right. The world is very different.
Which is fine. I'm fine with that. I wrote the book I set out to write. I'm happy with it. By the way, there are like a couple of things I say, oh, if I could do this, if I can make this one small change or that one small change, would I make this more explicit? Of course, it's not perfect. That's another thing that I think, if you can get rid of the belief that you can create something perfect, that also makes you much freer.
As a writer.
Yeah. It's like, it's never going to be perfect. No one's ever written a perfect novel. If you ever write, if someone writes the perfect novel, we can all stop.
What did you say at the beginning of the conversation? You said, because I think it really, to me, it says, to me, it's the essence of what this book is this style of what you created here. You said, I will always be a crime writer.
Yes.
But because you said it's a genre that allows you to do almost anything you want, that you can develop what you want and create something out of it. That's not necessarily a whodunit.
Right. The genre itself, it has no limitations. We've just, I swear, this conversation is now coming around, I feel like, every 6 months now. We used to be only have it once a year, where somebody literary decides that the crime novel is too popular, too successful, and they have to take it down a peg by talking about all the things that's wrong with it.
Right.
And it's a very complicated topic. I mean, first of all, literary novels are defined primarily by not belonging to any other genre. My sister is a bookseller and is very quiet and demure, but it can also be devastatingly witty if, you know, you're lucky enough to be the person who gets to hear her quiet, demure voice. Once joked about someone who had been a crime writer who announced that their new novel was a literary novel. My sister said, I think other people get to decide that, which I think is true. I mean, if you know, other novels are just novels. And, you know, if we're going to talk about literary as a quality, a lot of novels that are published as literary novels don't achieve that quality either. The thing that mixes people up about crime fiction is that it can succeed at a low level and a high level. There are books that are pure escapist fantasy that do the job of getting you through a plane trip. And by the way, that's a pretty hard thing to do. You know, if you can write a novel that holds someone's attention for 3 hours, and that's nothing to sneer at. Nick Hornby, I wish I had the exact words, when he was writing about Dennis Lehane's Mystic River, which is a terrific novel. You know, again, sure, it's a crime novel, but how does it not stand equal to the literary novels, you know, that were published that year? He said, if you can do everything that a literary novel does, and on top of it, have a crime story that you solve plausibly and satisfyingly, it's like, that's like angels dancing on the top of the pin. Or it's like doing a little tap dance on top of it all, I think is what he said. So, you know, again, I'm always happy to say, look, tell me I'm no good. I'm fine with that. Tell me that my work isn't doing everything it could, that it's not literary, that it is formulaic, fine. But the crime novel itself is not inherently limited.
And I agree with you, Laura. I think this is the best thing you've ever written. The Most Dangerous Thing, Laura Lippman's latest work, is out now. Tomorrow night is the book launch party at Barnes & Noble on St. Paul Street at 7 p.m. In Charles Village. And go there, meet Laura, pick up the book. It really is, it is the best she's ever done, The Most Dangerous Things. And Laura Lippman, good to have you with us once again.
Oh, thank you for everything, Mark.
Thanks. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.